I'm the moderator this morning, so I'm going to try and keep us on time, and I'm going to really just set the stage for what Mr. Barone and Dr. Mack are going to talk about. And I have been asked to fill in and present to you Rachel Cole's presentation on the HHS's CONOPS, and I'll do my best with that, but I think that Tony Barone will probably give you a little bit more detail about that. So we're going to do our best to cover the presentation for a colleague who was unable to make it here because they're responding to Sandy, or not able to travel because of Sandy. So the theme this morning is disaster behavioral health integration into the public health preparedness and response system. Many of you who are in the public health system and have responded to disasters may have been hearing this theme for a long time. It's been something that we've been trying to do for many, many years. But what we'd like to present to you today, first I'm going to do this overview about where we've come from and where we are now, so that we can give you an idea of where we think we need to go. And you'll hear Dr. Mack talk about a lot of the data about what we've been doing on the federal level. And Mr. Barone is going to talk about the gaps as well. So trying to help to make it clear to those of you who are in public health and do disaster work where we need to go and what our responsibilities are. Just to be formal and make sure we're addressing the APHA needs, I have no formal relationships to disclose. And again, we're going to go in a little bit different order this morning, so we'll try and keep you up to date. Basically, we're going to talk about the behavioral factors that directly and indirectly influence both individuals and communities, looking at risk, health, resilience, and the success of some of our emergency response strategies and the public health directives that have helped us with those strategies. If you've been watching the TV the last couple of days, you can see a vast difference in this large-scale disaster than we've seen to some of the previous ones because of some of those public health and behavioral health strategies that have been implemented. I'm going to give you a little bit of a history of public health and disaster behavioral health response, as well as where we are in the field today. I recognize it's early and people may be needing to get your coffee, so we'll try and infuse you a little bit this morning. We're going to talk about how the federal agencies work together, and it gets a little complicated, and I think that's one of our points, is to talk about the complexity, but we are going to introduce to you how the federal agencies work together, the responsibilities of coordination, collaboration, and of course the hardest thing to do is this communication that we need to keep going, and Mr. Barone will talk a little bit more about that as well. And Dr. Mack is going to talk specifically, I'll introduce the idea, but she'll talk specifically about the federally supported behavioral health services that are offered to communities in the aftermath of a federally declared disaster. You may have picked that up on the TV the last couple of days. There's a couple of states that have already been declared, been federally declared disasters, and that has a lot to do with what federal supports are available to them. An important piece of information. Over the past decade, actually it's now about 12 years, in the U.S. alone there's been an increase of 39% just in natural disasters, not mass violence, cluster suicide, some of the other incidents that we consider disasters. Just to make sure we're all speaking the same language, these events are defined in many ways, mostly climate-related emergencies, natural or human-caused, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis. We have hazardous material accidents, and of course, unfortunately, this increase in mass violence incidents, terrorist attacks, fires, those incidents that cause human suffering, that cause the sense of overwhelming terror and horror, what I call the I'm going to die effect. Even if it's not true, the perception that you might die or become seriously injured, or someone that you care about might die or become seriously injured, gives us that terror effect, basically overwhelming the community to response. And we've seen many examples of them here. The hurricane it could look similar to Sandy, but this is covering five states. You can't even see how the scope of Katrina. We all know the effect, unfortunately. And then the terrorist incident in Oklahoma City, in New York. We've seen many, many things going on in the past decade. Unfortunately, as we said, there is an increase, and we expect that that's not going to change very soon. So why do we care about integrating what mental health, behavioral health, and substance abuse, and the public health system? How many of you are public health administrators or clinicians, doctors, nurses, physicians, techs, in the public health as opposed to mental health field. Yeah, I imagine. So this is a question that comes up very often for people who are in the public health system and don't respond to or haven't responded to disasters. Our collaborative planning and exercising includes broad-scale public education, and you saw this examples of this in the public health system in the anthrax scare. We saw it in England, we saw it in Japan, the sarin gas attack, risk communications and crisis intervention in the post-disaster situation really help us to provide a more timely and efficient disaster response. So the integration is very important to us. In the United States, our emergency support function number 8 is where we work off of. It's the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Framework that Mr. Barone will be talking a little bit more about. This is where the disaster planning initiatives are really laid out, of course, now under Homeland Security. Public health and medical services include the mental health and substance abuse considerations. Now I'm going to talk like a mental health person. I'm going to whine a little bit and say, even though this ESFA function has been in there for many, many years, public health has control. And it makes it very, very difficult for when there's public health who don't understand the need for mental health services, for mental health to be at the table. This has been our history, and that has changed significantly. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But it does require that we coordinate our federal response, including the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, which is in the more recent National Response Framework. So, again, why public health and behavioral health? When many people think about mental health services, they think about Freud, they think about traditional mental health services, office-based psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, and that's really not what we're talking about here. We're talking about some of the types of interventions that are more familiar to public health providers. But let me tell you why, though, we need to integrate the mental health and substance abuse. Because psychological disorders are the second highest effect after physical injury or death post-disaster. And most people don't know that, again, unless you've been in the field responding. In the general population, there is a very low risk for people developing a major mental illness like major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or some of the other anxiety disorders. It's generally about 10%, and that's pretty consistent in the literature, except in large scale and scope events. Like 9/11 and Katrina, what we saw was that these numbers doubled. But you know, 20%, it's a small number, but it's significant. Why does it matter to you in the public health sector? Because if we don't reach these 10 or 20%, depending on the scope and scale of the disaster, they wind up developing longer-term or chronic problems, both physical and emotional, that often bring them into the public mental health and the public health system, long-term and very often chronic, reducing certainly their health, their mental health, but also taking away from the resources in the public health and public mental health system. A good example of that is the sarin gas attack. About 400 people were actually exposed in Japan to the sarin gas attack, but because about 8,000 thought they were, as I said before, perception is very important, thought they were exposed, what do? They overwhelmed the emergency rooms and the physicians and the healthcare clinics. They didn't think, oh, this could be psychological, you know. They really thought they were exposed, and they actually somatized and had symptoms that that overwhelmed the public health care system. But as I said before, our services that we provide, disaster behavioral health services, are very similar to the crisis intervention services that you see in the public health system. Crisis intervention began in the medical setting, certainly in emergency rooms, and continues there. We also saw crisis intervention then expand as we developed mental health institutions so that we could respond to people with serious and persistent mental illness who are in the general public and needed care. And of course, as you know, with the increase in the suicide rates in our country, that's been a large piece of the crisis intervention work, and we've learned a lot from that field as well. And then, of course, all of you who are responders, whether as EMS people, as emergency room folks, drivers, people who pick up the emergency phones. There's a huge number of people who provide crisis intervention services for everyday crises. Certainly motor vehicle accidents, the number one crisis in this country every day, and then the more interpersonal, distressing type events like assault, rape, domestic violence. And so our services actually began in the public health system. When we look at mental health and substance abuse, that's what we now call behavioral health. Not my favorite term, but I didn't say that. We're being recorded, so it's on record. But it's a little hard for some people to understand what that means. We talk about both mental health and substance abuse services as behavioral health, and this is really what makes up our field. It's a comprehensive discipline. Right now, including policy and service delivery, as well as evaluation and research, which Dr. Mack is going to talk about, but we're a baby of the sciences. We're less than 30 years old. And so when you hear the concerns that they don't know what they're doing or it changes all the time, that's because we're a growing field. And unfortunately, because of the increase in disasters, we are growing very rapidly, something that is not uncommon for one of the early sciences. And you'll hear as we talk about some of the real changes and improvements that we've made. And just an example, even the Red Cross didn't formally integrate mental health until 1989. Very, very recently, somebody's shaking their head, yes, so it's familiar, after the Sioux City airplane crash. And of course, now mental health service is a major component of what the Red Cross provides. This is a slide I'm going to move through quickly. You don't need to study, but just again to give you an idea of where we've come from. FEMA didn't exist until 1979. There was the first congressional act providing response to a disaster in New Hampshire. They love that that's their history as the first congressional act. It was in 1803. And in the 100 years between 1803 and 1903, the federal government responded to about 100 disasters. We started with the Reconstruction Finance Corps making loans. That gave rise to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' response to the Flood Control Act. That was the policy that was developed because of that spate of floods in the late 1930s. And then a stream of disasters in the 1960s really moved the progression to the Disaster Relief Act in 1974, and then the formal development of FEMA. The Disaster Behavioral Health Services come under the 1988 Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Act, along with many other services. We're only about 1% of that budget, but a significant percent. And then, as you know, after 9/11, the development of Homeland Security, with Director Joe Alba having handled the 9/11 events, coordinating with FEMA and moving disaster response to preparedness and national security, very quickly in 2003, developing over 22 agencies that form what's now Homeland Security. And after Katrina, we learned so much in that event that we actually had a significant policy change. The Post-Katrina Reform Act really pushes the mission of preparedness for FEMA and all of us who respond. So I'm going to just very quickly move through the Stafford Act, which talks about the federal response, because Dr. Mack is going to give you more detail about that. The Act really authorizes the Crisis Counseling Assistance and Training Program, what we refer to as the CCP. So once there's a presidential declaration, a state can request CCP funding. This includes short-term behavioral health crisis intervention when the state or the locality is overwhelmed by the incident. Remember, we're a states' rights government. The feds don't go running in as soon as a disaster happens unless the area is so totally devastated, the governor's dead, they can't ask for help. I mean, literally, we await or consult with the state about what they think their needs are. We respect the idea that we're a states' rights government, but also that communities themselves really are best at knowing what they need and how to set up their recovery. Our role is really as a support role. We've been managing the Federal Emergency Management Agency funds the CCP program, and it's administered by SAMHSA, and this has been going on for about 37 years. It's been very critical to the health of the nation. And what we find is that many people in the public health sector don't even know about the CCP program. It's vital and it's important, and you'll hear Dr. Mack talk about the outcomes of the CCP program. Then we have SAMHSA, our Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is under Health and Human Services. It's under HHS, established in 1972. Really to target substance abuse and mental health services to the people most in need, to look at the current research and how to translate that into the general health care system. And we've had a number of administrators. We're currently under Administrator Hyde, who's now managing Sandy at this moment. So where are we currently? We've actually moved to, in this, you know, kind of 30 to 40 year history that we have, of a discipline that now has created an evidence base of mental health interventions that first do no harm. We follow the same rules as the medical field, but also those that show promise of mitigating, of decreasing the development of serious traumatic stress from these incidents that are occurring. The interventions themselves include psychological first aid. I hope that most of you have heard of what we call PFA. If you haven't, it's a very practical, make sense intervention. You can access it online for free. I suspect if you've been in the field for a while, you can cover it in the less than 6 hours. So please take advantage of psychological first aid. It's something we all need to know. We look at screening, monitoring, and assessment of people in the field who've been affected. Crisis counseling, which is a major component of the federal intervention, the CCP program. We, of course, look at risk communications, as we talked about before, public education. Public risk communications can either increase or decrease anxiety in the community. We add suicide prevention, although there is not an increase. There's no research about any increase in suicides after disasters. The media does pick up on them and talk about suicide, so there's a perception that suicides increase after disasters. They don't, but of course, we still need to monitor for those who might be suicidal after an event. And we're now using what is called the trauma-informed perspective. This is important for us in the disaster behavioral health field because the trauma-informed perspective tells us that most people, huge percentage of folks in this country, 33% or more, have had at least one incident of trauma, interpersonal trauma, before the age of 18. Many people have had 2, 3, 4 events. That's important for us because if you have had previous trauma, it can put you at higher risk for developing some type of a mental disorder after a disaster if there is some triggering of some of the previous effects of a previous trauma. And now in the later phases of recovery, after that initial phase is over, we have evidence that cognitive behavioral treatment and eye movement desensitization help with some of the more severe types of mental disorders like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. That said, let me reiterate, PTSD is the least occurring disorder that happens after traumatic events. It's a serious problem. And certainly you see it in our veteran population who've had massive exposure to trauma. But after disasters, it is the smallest effect. You see more depression and other anxiety-like disorders. So our interventions are currently being taught in both the public health and mental health as a means of preparing our workforce. The worst thing is to be out there in a disaster and not know what you're doing. We look for our public health partners to have that compassionate presence, which most of you have. You're in the field already. And the sense of competence that this is an effective thing to do. The Psychological First Aid Manual tells us that helping people to calm themselves, to feel safe, to feel secure, to feel cared about, to feel cared for, to be in a safe place, and that to be not alone, not isolated, and having social supports are all some of the majorly important pieces of helping people after a disaster so that we can mitigate the development of other disorders. So I know that's a kind of a quick overview. My colleagues are going to talk a little bit more in detail, and we should have time for questions. So next, Dr. Mack is going to talk about the Disaster Technical Assistance Center and the data from the field. I'm going to come back up and try and present Rachel Cole's information, and then Anthony Barone will talk about both the CONOPS and speak to us as a responder from the field.